Are your school days out of sight when you took English, art, and math? What's your favorite Fahrenheit? How sour are the grapes of wrath? Do you need a challenger for discussing Salinger? Do you love the written word? What happened to the mockingbird? Our show is just beginning, so find a place to sit. These questions will be on the test. It's time for Sophomore Lit.
Welcome back to Sophomore Lit, where we reread your 10th grade reading list. I'm John McCoy, and with me is visiting co-host Sarah If Decker. And Sarah, would you introduce yourself and tell everyone out there about where they might hear you elsewhere?
Yeah, so I'm a medieval historian. I teach at Indiana University. I teach Jewish history in particular and work on women and gender and Jewish studies in the Iberian Peninsula in particular. And I have a podcast, Media Evil, where I talk about essentially medieval movies and how they depict the medieval world and in most cases why they're wrong.
Well, this time we've got our hands on an actual piece of medieval culture, although albeit a late medieval, almost on the cusp of the Renaissance, I believe written in 1400, is that right?
Yeah, so written down in about 1400 and then would have been available in manuscript form primarily to most people for the beginning of its history, essentially.
Sir Gawain and the Green Knight, for whom the author is unknown, typically either called the Gawain poet or called the Pearl poet after another poem that was in the same manuscript and assumed to be written by the same guy or woman. Who knows? There's been a lot of speculation about who wrote these poems. We don't know much except that his lexicon appears to be northern, as in Yorkshire region of England, written almost exactly the same time that Chaucer was writing Canterbury Tales.
Yes,
but if you are the kind of person who had a class in Chaucer when you were in college and you studiously learned the prologue and I find the Middle English in Sir Gawain a lot more impenetrable than Chaucer.
Yeah, I think it would be much more challenging to high school students in particular. I am not sure that I would recommend anyone inflict the Middle English upon them for this.
So for this one, I'm reading it in the translation by Simon Armitage. Are you reading which translation?
So I decided to take a look at the Armitage translation as well. I had heard good things about it. It's a fairly new translation and is much like the Seamus Heaney Beowulf, I believe, is making the effort to have it be a more kind of literary translation and emphasize the sound and the alliteration and the meter of the Middle English. And I think that works really well in a lot of new translations. And so I was excited to check that out. And it does have a dual facing Middle English text as well.
Yeah. Simon Armitage, I wasn't aware of this, but he's apparently the current poet laureate of Great Britain. And there is a wonderful hour long special he did for the BBC about Sir Gawain and the Green Knight, where he travels through parts of Yorkshire looking for the features mentioned in this poem. Did you happen to see that? Or it's on YouTube, I believe.
No, I didn't get a chance to take a look at that, but that's interesting. And yeah, because it's a very distinctive accent, of course, and way of speaking. And so it's something that is interesting to think about how that then comes out, because, as I said, the kind of alliteration and the language is really something that he's very excited about doing in interesting ways.
This is a podcast about rereading works that you read when you were younger. Do you have a history with this poem beyond this podcast?
Yeah, so I did not quite make it to this poem in high school in sophomore lit, but I did make it to this poem as a sophomore in college. I took, as a young medievalist, I took a Middle English and a kind of Old English and Middle English course, which included this text.
And what did you think of it then?
The main memories that I have in terms of reading it were, first and foremost, I remember that the Middle English was in fact much harder than Chaucer, which is what we'd read immediately previous to this, and that being somewhat daunting because we were, for that class, expected to primarily be reading it in the Middle English. And the other thing that I remember being especially struck by at the time, and then still struck by now, is that there is a kind of striking, I would say, kind of turn toward misogyny in a way that is not entirely surprising in a medieval text, but one that ended up being, I guess I would say, in the end, a little more vicious than I often expect in Arthurian literature in particular.
I read this in college in a class in Middle English, and I remember we had gotten to this after we had read several miracle plays and some mystery plays and a lot of riddles and bestiary entries, which are common genres in Middle English. And we got to this, and I remember that I was the only one in the class who kind of liked this poem, that everyone else said, oh, this poem, they found this poem irrelevant. But and my poor professor, who loved the poems, had us read Pearl next and said, well, maybe you'll find that more relevant. And no one found that relevant either, unfortunately.
Really?
Now, you mentioned the alliterative form of this verse. And one of the things that is interesting about this poem to me is that while today it is recognized as sort of one of the great works of Middle English, it was not influential the way that Chaucer was influential, because the manuscript upon which it was written was in a private collection and didn't really emerge to the larger reading public until the middle of the 19th century. So
yes,
it's a poem that, while I think it's an excellent sample of its kind, didn't really have, you know, it didn't have the good luck. Chaucer had really good luck because, first of all, he wrote for the court and he got a lot of stuff got copied down by hand. And then within the next century, along came the printing press. And so Chaucer also got to be one of the first authors that got printed and distributed that way. Gawain and the Green Knight is sort of the last great hurrah of the alliterative tradition that we think of from like Beowulf going on down, which was alliterative and stressed verse, although there is some rhyming in it as well. In fact, I think it's a very elaborate system of poetics that goes through this poem, but not nearly as elaborate as the system of poetics that go through Pearl, which is a crazy poem as far as the amount of internal rhymes and the repeated words and stuff.
Yes, and I don't have quite as good of an ear for meter as I sometimes wish I had, but it was I really enjoyed basically being able to kind of every now and then take a look back at the Old English and then try to get a sense of what this would have really sounded like. And that it's, of course, we don't know that much of the history about this poem. We don't know anything about the author except what we might be able to guess based on his works, which is always a somewhat complicated endeavor in terms of working backwards in that manner. And so we know very little about who then would have read this poem, and if anyone would have read this poem, because it belonged to this private collection. We don't know if there were other manuscripts ever made of this text that haven't survived. But it's interesting to kind of think about in what context people might have accessed this text, or if anyone ever did really at all.
Yeah, I think the other thing that is interesting from a context standpoint is where this text falls in the history of Arthurian legends.
Mm-hmm.
While today Arthur is synonymous with England, if there ever were an historical Arthur, he was likely a Welsh warlord, and the first great epics about Arthur were written in Welsh. There's a poem called Culwic and Olwen, which I think is a hilarious poem It's one of the very first Arthurian poems. I definitely have only read that in translation, knowing no Middle Welsh.
Middle Welsh is not a skill of mine either, sadly, although I have friends who are experts in Middle Welsh.
But by the time this poem was written, Arthur was really more of a French hero. He was in the 13th century. It was like Chrétien de Troyes and the and the continental romances that were taking up the Arthurian stories, sort of like the way today in Germany they have such a fondness for stories about cowboys and Indians.
Yeah, and it's in France as well that you see the development of a really impressive and elaborate visual tradition surrounding the Arthurian legends, that there's a lot of these manuscripts of Chrétien de Troyes and other French language, old French Arthurian epics are then very richly illustrated. And so there is this kind of broad visual tradition.
Right. So this is kind of a bit of a taking back into the British Isles of the Arthurian stories. And this story, as far as I know, is not, unlike, say, Malory, La Mort d'Arthur, which basically took all the Chrétien de Troyes and other continental sources and reworked them for a contemporary English readership. This seems to be an original story, or at least one that we don't know the source for.
Yes, that's my understanding as well, that this precisely kind of details of this tale don't appear elsewhere. There's thematic links to other Arthurian stories in terms of the kind of elements of people being in various disguises, knights who are rather mysterious in various ways, that this is something that we have these kind of elements, but this particular narrative is, to the best of my knowledge also, that this is the only place in which it appears.
Normally, we don't go too deep into the weeds about the kind of textual analysis that we're doing right now. So maybe we should move actually into sort of response to the poem. I wanted to go over a lot of this because, first of all, it's not often that I actually have an expert on the podcast. It's usually just me and another interested amateur speculating about things here. So I'm glad to have you here. But secondly, it does help a little bit to contextualize. This does come at the end, the very end of the medieval period. And that is, I think, important to remember when we're talking about this, because it's a story that's already looking backwards to a mythical past. And it's a story that, as I hope will become apparent, has some satirical elements to it. In some ways, it plays into the Romantic tradition, and in other ways, it's parodic of the Romantic tradition. And those are some of the reasons why I think it's a unique poem.
Yes, and just a couple of or kind of very brief comment as well about the historical context for this poem. I think it's interesting to think about it as well as a text that's being created at what is really, I would say, a moment of crisis in a lot of ways, that we are relatively shortly after the Black Death. We are also relatively shortly after a peasants' revolt in England. This is a period in which the English monarchy is in some ways rather unstable during the course of this period. And so it's looking back, on, as you said, onto this kind of idealized past, and it's looking back onto an idealized past at precisely a moment where perhaps in England in approximately 1400, things don't necessarily seem so great.
It's really looking back on the past because its opening lines are not about Arthur, but about the fall of Troy. The medieval world loved to gain authenticity by connecting your story either to the Bible or to classical sources. There was a whole genre of medieval manuscripts called universal histories. Mm-hmm. Basically, if you were the king somewhere, you'd get your family tree laid out, but it wouldn't just go back to the earliest you could trace it in France. It would go all the way back to Adam and Eve, and so there was, you tried to give yourself legitimacy, And ever since, I think it was in Geoffrey of Monmouth, that there was this tradition in England of this guy named Brutus, who was mm-hmm. was he a descendant of Aeneas, or?
I believe he claimed descent from Aeneas, yeah.
So it was like a bit of Aeneas made its way to Britain, and that gives Britain claim to, I don't know, being on the winning side at Troy, I guess.
Yes, and so, or it has, so it has that connection, and then of course Aeneas is linked to Rome, and this is very much a period where everybody wants to have that connection to Rome and the Roman Empire as this idealized moment in history in a lot of ways. Yeah, and of course, so there's that interest. And just a note on these genealogies as well, in England in particular, there are these really fabulous genealogical scrolls in which the current English kings in the, I think the ones that I've seen at least are 13th or 14th century, trace their lineage back to Aeneas, and as well include Arthur in this.
Well, also there's that tradition in Arthurian legends. It was supposedly Joseph of Arimathea who brought the Grail to England, which is why Arthurian knights could feel somewhat confident wandering around England looking for the Holy Grail.
Right. And then, of course, this classical past and the biblical past are very much kind of interconnected and interwoven together and very much seen as both things that are important and culturally relevant.
This story opens at Camelot at Christmas time. Christmas revels weren't always religiously based. They certainly seem to have their roots in pre-Christian traditions, and particularly mm-hmm. in this idea of revelry that featured lots of drinks, lots of competitions, and the telling of ghost stories was common. I don't know if it dates back to the medieval times. It certainly had gained currency around the time of Victorian England, which is why Christmas Carol is kind of a traditional ghost story yeah. for Christmas. Do you know anything about the medieval traditions of Christmas?
I haven't come across the ghost stories in particular as being something linked to Christmas. The material that I'm aware of interrelated to this is very much that it is very much a day of feasting, and in fact is associated with quite a long period of feasting, kind of going from Christmas to Three Kings Day on January 6th, the Feast of the Epiphany. And so it is this kind of major celebratory time, certainly, and that it is already relatively early, and so in this period associated as well with the exchange of gifts.
So we've got the whole court of Camelot there. We get some little cameo appearances by Arthur and Guinevere. I believe Lancelot is mentioned. So the gang's all here, and that's interesting to me because earlier Arthurian legends don't really, they're kind of piecemeal, like what actually happened, who was actually involved. That doesn't all kind of crystallize into what we think of as sort of the definitive version of Arthur until Malory. So it's interesting to see that all these characters are here. There's a lot of description of food in this poem. So if you're the kind of person who likes to hear how many soups were served at a meal, then this is a poem for you.
Yes, and it's always fun to kind of read these very elaborate descriptions of medieval feasts, which are very interested in display and in the visuals of the feast, as well as the kind of taste of the food itself. And so it's really interesting to see how that comes out in this poem as well, which one could potentially use as a bit of a food history source if one wished to.
Into this moment of revelry walks the titular Green Knight, and it's a wonderful introduction of the night. He walks into the hall. Well, actually, his horse walks into the hall. The Green Knight is riding his horse into the very hall where everyone is banqueting. He's holding aloft a branch of holly, and nobody knows who he is or what he is. He's described as being tall and hairy and well-formed and handsome. And then only at the last minute is, I mean, the very last line of the stanza that he's introduced, is it mentioned that he is, in fact, green all over.
Yes, and it sort of gradually leads into it that it begins with just things like his clothing, which of course would be normal, of course, for it to be whatever color he wanted it to be, and then gradually leads into this supernatural element, essentially, that there is something about him which is not entirely normal. He's not just a knight who has appeared.
Yeah, you mentioned before that there are these parallels with other stories of the appearance of a supernatural knight. This would be a moment of expectation for the reader, or if it was read aloud, an expectation for the audience of, okay, now here comes the call to arms for the poem, and everyone's waiting to see what this guy is going to want. And he makes an absurd challenge to a duel.
Yes, it's a duel that very much is not in accordance with the standards of medieval dueling, that this is not how a fight would typically work. And in its bizarreness, it therefore, I would say, that is the explanation provided for why initially everyone is so hesitant, because it is not within the norms.
The Green Knight offers to trade blows with anyone any of the assembled people, by which he means he will put his head down and not flinch as that person strikes him with an axe, and with the condition that in a year's time that person must appear and receive the blow in turn, which of course sounds absurd, because you know what's a headless person going to do to you in a year's time. I think it's notable that King Arthur jumps up and he's the first one who wants to take care of the Green Knight. But Gawain, his nephew, says, no, let me do this. Gawain is kind of the youngster of Camelot and eager to prove himself, I think.
Yes, but it's interesting that he also presents himself and argues in favor of him being the one chosen for this particular challenge, in part on the basis that he is a person who is inessential, and that he will be the one least missed, essentially, if this all doesn't go well, which it seems very possible, given the supernatural nature of this figure, that it couldn't.
Gawain does take the axe to the Green Knight, which goes just about how you would expect. The Green Knight is decapitated, his head goes sliding across the floor, and we're told that the knights kick it as it as it slides past. The poet loves talking about bodily stuff in this throughout this poem. There's lots of scenes in which he's describing people's bodies. He's describing wounds. Later in the poem, he's going to describe animals being eviscerated. He likes to linger on these sorts of things.
Yeah, which is very early 15th century, that this is really a period where medieval literature and medieval art are very much obsessed with physicality and materiality in a lot of ways. And this is something that's coming up in medieval religion, too, at this time.
So the Green Knight doesn't seem to be too bothered by the loss of his head. He picks it up and puts it back on his shoulders, and he leaves, admonishing Gawain, now you have to seek me out in a year's time. You have to seek me out on New Year's Day in a year's time. So not a little bit longer than a year, but still within the Christmas season.
Yes, kind of right in the middle of it, basically.
And as he leaves, we were told that all the assembled throng starts joking and laughing again, trying to raise everyone's spirits. Gawain is, of course, a bit gobsmacked at what he's gotten himself into.
Yeah.
But I do know that there's this courtly tradition, at least I know it from later French tradition, that members of court are supposed to put on a brave face and always be cheerful around other members of court. That's part of what it means to be a courtier. Is it's seen as bad manners to be depressed or in any way bring down the mood.
Yeah, and this is kind of the kind of beginnings of that, I would say, in terms of that emphasis on this kind of courtly mannerism.
And so Gawain passes a year's time, and there's a lovely two verses here, or whatever you would call them, long. The book is arranged in what are called fits. There's like these four fits, and then there are these verses that vary in length, but they are primarily alliterative, and they end with the small rhyming passage called the Bob and Wheel. It produces this really wonderful forward momentum for the story. And these passages that discuss the seasons passing one after another, mm-hmm. I think these are the passages that get excerpted from this quite frequently. If anything gets excerpted from this poem, one of them is a Facebook quote of mine, which I is kind of pretentious, I think, but... So within a year's time, Gawain has to go off and set off on his trip to find the Green Chapel, which is where he's been told he will find the Green Knight. And he has no idea where that is.
Right, since it is not a standard place. And so essentially he just kind of sets off and hopes for the best.
We're treated to a little sequence of him being suited up. This is again common for the poet to discuss people putting on clothes and taking off clothes, and a lot of emphasis placed upon the propriety of a grand knight like Gawain going off into the world with his lovely suit of armor. If you are someone who a member of the Society for Creative Anachronism, you'll probably eat this section up. Gawain has all kinds of adventures that are just alluded to as he's wandering around trying to figure out where the Green Knight is, including at one point he's set upon by giants.
Yes.
And this reminds me actually of a passage from The Hobbit, where in the people who know primarily Lord of the Rings and who don't necessarily remember The Hobbit, The Hobbit was a very silly book and very strange. Mm-hmm. And there's a segment where Gandalf and the dwarves and Bilbo are trying to go through the Misty Mountains by climbing over the mountains, and they are set upon by giants. And it's confusing because you're not quite sure whether Tolkien wants you to take it seriously or not.
Yeah.
When they made those pretty bad movies of The Hobbit, they did actually render that sequence as literal, but I never quite could tell whether Tolkien was just having a joke at our expense at that point or not. And similarly, right. In this book, I don't know what we're supposed to make of this. It's sort of like we're just mentioned that giants chase him at one point, and that's all we get.
Right, and it's very casual about it, and very much kind of emphasizing there are these kind of side things, but clearly this isn't the important thing. Clearly the important thing is that we're ultimately going to be going back to his eventual encounter with this Green Knight.
Right. So, and I think it's kind of a bait and switch on the author's part, because we're being treated at this point to what we think is going to be a chivalric quest. This seems very like, it's very, very like Percival going out for the Grail or whatever. It's the you kind of know what form that's going to take. But ultimately what happens is Gawain happens across a castle, and he's asking them if they've heard about this Green Knight, and the guy says, "Oh sure, I know where he is. He's just over there a couple blocks away. Come on in. Spend the time with us now for the next week or so while you're waiting to go out and get your head cut off."
Yeah, spend Christmas here.
Yeah.
So I don't know if we want to have spoilers at this point for the end of the book, or not quite.
We can go ahead and spoil everything. Just assume, listener, that we're just going to discuss the entire plot. So don't. So if you haven't read the poem, go out and read it. It's what? It's like 2,000 lines long. It's like nothing.
Yeah. So it does. Already, in terms of a couple of little descriptive elements, highlight the fact that, of course, his knightly host is hers, or his lordly host is going to then turn out to in fact be the Green Knight. And in particular, I'd say the kind of big thing is, first of all, this emphasis on, they both are described as having these very, at least in this translation, these kind of big bushy beards. And that there is this emphasis on his kind of redness in some ways, although not in as much of an unnatural way, which is in some ways similar in terms of the construction to the Green Knight's greenness.
Astute readers will know what's going on right away, but the joy in this is the way in which, again, there's a certain confounding of expectations. You know, we're led to expect rising tension until Gawain finally encounters the Green Knight and something's going to happen, and we don't know how that's going to turn out. But instead, he's brought inside this castle by a lord, and he's told, you know, here, hang out. You basically spend your days in bed. we'll take care of your every need, and I'm going to go off hunting, by the way, and then we're treated to yet another absurd, not necessarily a wager, but more like an absurd promise, which is that the lord of the castle says, when I go hunting, anything that I manage to acquire becomes your property, and while you're hanging out here at the castle, anything that you acquire during the day, you have to give to me.
Yes, and in that it's very clearly, I would say, being presented as a trick of some kind, although Gawain takes it in this very kind of friendly spirit, since he, of course, is, I guess, perhaps less suspicious than our audience.
It reminds me of this, there's a medieval trope called the rash promise, which is whenever in a story about knights, if someone comes up and says, you must promise me you will do what I ask you, which as modern readers, we find that just bizarre that anyone would say, sure, go ahead and ask me and I will do whatever it is you ask me. and typically it does not end well for the person. And, you know, I think as modern readers, you have to be aware that the people writing this story were absolutely aware of the absurdity of it, and that was part of the joy of writing these stories. In some ways, this is a poem about the limitations of chivalry. We should mention, by the way, that when Gawain comes in the first night and he's given a banquet, where we're told there are something like four soups and fishes and bread, we see the lady of the castle, who is exceedingly beautiful, and she is walking arm in arm with a haggard old crone, who, of course, this is like Chekhov's crone. We're going to...
Yes.
Not much more is said about her, except the narrator seems to think it important to point out that no man would ever want to look at her when the beautiful lady was around.
Right, and there is a heavy emphasis on this point at describing both of these women's bodies and using the body of the crone to illustrate, by way of contrast, the beauty of the other woman.
What you gonna do? So instead of Gawain, I don't know what he would be doing at this point, polishing his armor, making peace with his god, you know, looking for some magical way to survive the Green Knight's blow. We are given 3 days of the Lord going out and hunting, and Gawain staying in bed and becoming the hunted. The lady of the house has strong designs upon Gawain, and they are not, she's not particularly subtle about those designs. She crawls into bed with Gawain and says, hey, do with me whatever you want to do with me.
Yes, and I love this scene in particular because I think there's often a misconception of the Middle Ages as being this rather prudish time, where, of course, no one would ever be, you know, this close to being, you know, almost sexually explicit, you know, not in terms of anything actually happening, but in terms of it being quite clear what she is asking for and what she is, you know, attempting, and that she is not at all shy about this. and that he turns her down, but does not express shock or horror or immediate, oh, I'm clearly going to tell your husband that you're trying to commit adultery.
Yeah, the conflict for Gawain is he can't give in to her because that would be impure of him to do, and it would be a betrayal of hospitality for him to give in to her. But on the other hand, he can't just straight out say no to her, because that would also be a betrayal of hospitality, and
yes,
particularly a betrayal of the request of a lady, which a knight is always supposed to honor. So the play between him and the lady of the castle is how he can spurn her without actually saying that aloud.
Yes, and so he spends a lot of time talking with her and accepts from her ultimately kisses, but nothing beyond that, which he then does in turn, as promised, pass on to the Lord of the Castle.
Right. The Lord of the Castle, the first day he gets a deer, or is it a hind, which I guess is also another word for deer. We're given these wonderful sequences of hunting and of butchery, and the Lord comes home full of venison, hands it over to Gawain, and Gawain gives him a kiss on the cheek. And the Lord says, you know, oh, you've made the better bargain here. And the next day he gets a boar. And the third day he gets a fox. I think that's a kind of an odd progression in a way, because the boar is definitely more dangerous than the deer. And so there's kind of rising tensions here. The fox is, I guess, more elusive and slippery. So perhaps there's thematically a parallel between what's going on with the lady at that point.
I was going to say foxes are in particular associated with treachery as well.
Right.
So relevant also to Gawain's actions on that third day.
Right. At one point, the fox is referred to as Reynard, which readers of Chaucer will recognize as the folkloric aspect of foxes, as the mischief makers and the trick players. Because on the third day, the lady does succeed in getting Gawain to accept more than a kiss. She offers him her green sash, which she says, or girdle from her gown, basically like, you know, a little pull tie that you would pull around as a belt, and says, this is a magical girdle. It will protect you from any blows that would harm you. And Gawain says, say, that might come in useful.
That's exactly what I've been looking for.
Right. So that evening, when the Lord appears at the castle, Gawain gives the kiss he got that day, but not the girdle. He does not mention that he'd gotten this girdle, and he keeps that to himself.
And there is also a complication in that this is the first time, I believe, in which the lady has explicitly asked him not to say anything about the gift to her husband. So he obviously has a reason not to want to say anything. But in addition to his own reasons, he also would be betraying a kind of promise that he is pressured into making by her.
Now, that is an interesting point. It seems up till now, the lady has seemed to be a free agent, who doesn't seem particularly concerned about her husband one way or another. But now she's giving him explicit instructions about things. So Gawain, we're set up. It's the final day. He's heading out on New Year's Eve with an attendant, who says on the way to the Green Chapel, he says, you know, by the way, if you were to leave now, no one would blame you. I wouldn't tell anyone what had happened. You could basically go into witness protection, start a new life, do whatever you want. you know, which is a kind of nice on the attendant's behalf to be looking out for Gawain that way. But Gawain won't do that.
Yeah, and of course it is very apparent in some ways that this is likely to be a test of some kind, that he undoubtedly at least is given many, many opportunities throughout to make the choice to not in fact, meet the challenge that has been set to him.
He arrives at the Green Chapel. It's not clear to me reading this through exactly what kind of a place this is. It's kind of like a natural feature in the forest where he arrives.
It's described as a mound in this translation.
Simon Armitage, in his special, talks about the poet's affinity towards nature and the way that people often associate the Green Knight with nature or some sort of a natural force, or at least a pagan sort of force that exists, you know, outside of civilization and certainly outside of Christianity. And there are in Yorkshire these mounds and these springs and these sacred spaces that have significance and spiritual significance that predates or at least exists outside of Christianity. Armitage goes so far as to make the claim that this makes this poem sort of a environmentalist poem. I wouldn't go so far as to say that, but Armitage does do a good job with his translation. So if that helped him to conceive of the way of this poem, that it's something to think about, I guess.
Right. There certainly is an emphasis on the description of the environment. I'm not sure that I would quite agree with the interpretation of it as an environmentalist poem, in part because I'm not sure it's entirely clear whether exactly how positively or negatively we're supposed to see the Green Knight, which I think has a lot of bearing on that, and that if he is the person ultimately associated with the environment is at least portrayed as a potentially dangerous force, if nothing else.
Well, let's talk about what happens. And so as he approaches, he hears the Green Knight sharpening his axe. And I guess, you know, he's made it this far. He's in all the way. And he leans over to bare his neck and receive the blow. The knight brings down the axe, but stops at the last minute saying, "You flinched. Yeah, you know, this isn't fair. I didn't flinch when you cut my head off." And Gawain steals himself, and again the knight is brought down and says that he's just testing his nerve, but now we'll finally go through with this. At this point, if I were Gawain, I would say, like, no, that wasn't the deal. You know, you've had your swipes, but
you've had two. You don't get another one.
But at the third swipe, the axe glances off of Gawain's neck, and it leaves a little gash, a little nick in the back of his neck. Gawain is shocked to find himself still alive. He bolts up, he pulls out his sword, and he says, "That's it. You got it. You did it all." And the knight makes his big reveal. You want to give the big reveal here?
Yes, that the whole time the lord that Gawain has been enjoying his time with for the last few days, in fact, the whole time was the Green Knight, and that he was in fact being tested by the lord who was in fact in collusion with his wife, who was in fact deliberately seducing him to see if he would, or attempting to seduce him to see if he would give in, and as well to see if he would keep his promise in terms of being honest to the lord about what he had received on any given day.
Right, right. And this lord, you've mentioned before, his name is, it's Lord Bertilac, but his whole name is ridiculous. It's like Bertilac de Haltdessert, Haltdessert. On top of all that, this was all a scheme cooked up by the quintessential Arthurian villainess, Morgan Le Fay, who was in fact the elderly woman that Gawain saw. And it was done... Ultimately, they say it was ultimately done as an insult to Arthur and to scare Guinevere, to make Guinevere
yes.
be terrified because she would see a guy get his head cut off in the court at Camelot. So
essentially just kind of messing with them.
Yeah, she's just screwing around with him. And Bertilac, you know, then says like, you were great. You did everything you needed to do. Come on back. Come on, hang out at the castle. No hard feelings.
Mm-hmm. Come hang out with your aunt. since Morgan is, of course, his aunt, since he is Arthur's nephew and therefore also hers.
Right. So Arthur did not have a good family life, by the way. If you're not up on your Arthurian legends, you can look that up. But Gawain is deeply, deeply ashamed because the Green Knight has told him that the reason that he got two blows that nothing happened and the third time he got that nick was because the first 2 days he gave back exactly what he had been given. But on the third day, he withheld the girdle, and he is not considered entirely to blame because he did that out of fear of his own life. And that's understandable. So all he gets is the nick.
Not a full head chop off.
But Gawain is having none of this. He is utterly ashamed that he has been discovered in being untrue to his word, in breaking the terms of the promise. And he can't forgive himself for that. And he can't bring himself to go back and hang out with the castle and make chummy with the lady who has been playing these head games with him and with the sorceress who seems to have engineered everything. But neither is he going to hold it against them. They leave on fairly good terms. And there's nothing for it but for Gawain to get back to Camelot.
Yes, and I do just want to note that he is very much emphasizing at this point his own failings, both in terms of breaking his promise and in terms of being cowardly, because he does not see being afraid for his life ultimately as an excuse. But that the only excuse that he really provides for his conduct is essentially, well, of course I was tricked by a woman. Everyone gets tricked by women. Women are terrible. And provides a nice little litany of biblical examples of men being tricked by women to their downfall.
That is an unfortunate passage in this poem, because otherwise I'm very fond of this poem. That seems very, very sour at that point. And it also seems it takes away from, I think, what the power of the ending of this poem is, which I think this poem actually has a very beautiful and powerful ending for Gawain mm-hmm. to externalize his failure, because what the ending of this poem is Gawain returns to Camelot and everyone's first of all absolutely shocked that he's still alive and overjoyed to see him, and then he tells the story about what happened. And he says, "It's this green sash. I can't believe that I broke my promise. I can't believe that I was so untrue. I will wear this green sash for the rest of my life to remind me of my failure." And all the knights of Camelot laugh at him at that and say, "It's ridiculous. Gawain, you're ridiculous. We love you. And we're all going to wear green sashes too."
Yes, which is very charming. And in some ways, it's actually charming on both sides, both him admitting fault and trying to therefore, in some ways, I would say attempting at least to therefore grow as a person. And then others coming around and rallying around him to then tell him that you are taking your fault and your mistake far more seriously than any normal person would take it.
I actually find this, the ending of this poem, to be immensely touching. And while the poem has been parodic, and while it has sort of poked fun at the chivalric tradition, and while it has in many ways been a very secular poem, this is where it kind of comes home and sort of reinforces its sort of Christian roots, in that it's mm-hmm. saying you can't be perfect. Nobody can be perfect. And the whole project of Camelot and of the knights is in some ways flawed. We are all human, and we should all recognize that. And the fact that the knights recognize it is quite lovely. Also, the poem wraps around at the end to bring it back to Troy, And
yes.
It ends with the French phrase, Honnez soit mal y pense, which is from the Knights of the Garter, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
The Knights of the Garter were a chivalric order that wore a garter. And so in some ways, it seems like an origin story for that garter, if we're to assume that this green sash eventually became the garter that the Knights of the Garter wore. But that's a very late medieval, going into the Renaissance order that is also backwards looking. You know, it's trying to kind of attach itself to ideas of nobility that were from times gone by. So, you know, I think that the poem does just a marvelous job of kind of folding back in on itself and bringing together all these little threads it's had going through it of you know, because it's a poem that, you know, promises daring do and then doesn't deliver it and then does kind of in the end. So
yeah. And I think it's very much emphasizing also that the moments where the court at Camelot and Arthur's group is at its best in Arthurian legends is when there is true fellowship and solidarity. And that is, of course, something that is evidenced by their decision to rally around him and to all wear this garter as their, or this girdle as their sign. And in terms of looking backwards as well, that something that you can perhaps see as a relic of bygone ages that might be especially idealized in a moment where there is quite a bit of conflict amongst the English nobility.
Any other thoughts you have about the poem or its place in literature or its place alongside other Arthurian stories?
The other thing that I really wanted to highlight in particular is that one of the things that I love about this poem in terms of something that would be, I think, really useful in terms of presenting the medieval world to a high school or undergraduate audience is that even while there are these kind of pagan bits here and there, there's also a real emphasis in a lot of ways on how important Christianity is, both to the characters and therefore probably really to the 15th century audience or the 15th century person who is writing this poem and then the people who would be reading this poem, that people are very invested in their faith, are very interested in how Mary and Jesus are these figures who are being invoked as protectors. And that this is very much a poem that in some ways is about religious faith as well as being fundamental to the background of the choices that these knights and other people are making.
Yeah. No, I think that's a good point. I think that this poem shares with Chaucer that emphasis upon season and time. If you think about it, everyone thinks about with Chaucer, the general prologue and talking about April and what it means and about the sort of the seasonal return of pilgrims traversing England and all of Europe in the spring. And this is a poem that traces a calendar year, and it starts at Christmas time and it ends in the new year. And I think that it's very reflective of the feelings of sort of being in the middle of winter, the Yule tradition was placed near the solstice for a reason. It was like this was the absolute darkest part of the year, and then it ends with the sort of the renewal of the new year. I think that those things are lovely and beautiful. I think it's a hilarious poem. A very funny poem, surprisingly funny. And if you can read a good translation like Armitage, you can get something of the feel for what the original Middle English was like. If you can just sit and speak aloud the Middle English, whether you understand it or not, I think you can get also that feeling of, this was the way that English poetry was going for most of its history. The Anglo-Saxon tradition was alliterative. It was Chaucer who brought the continental styles to the English court, and he was basing that primarily upon French models.
And yes.
So the reason we think of poetry as rhymed in this country, in England and in America, is largely because of Chaucer. It could have gone a different way, and this is the other way it could have gone.
Yes, and it is, I think, really interesting and important as well to then think about the extent to which Old English, a language that I would say, if you read Middle English as a current English speaker, it's hard and you don't entirely understand it, especially in poems like this that I think have a slightly more difficult Middle English, but you can kind of parse it, and I would say Chaucer in particular, you can really kind of parse, even if you don't have a lot of formal training. Old English is really a different language in terms of its relationship to modern English. And I think it is important to think about the extent to which there is a lot of continuity in this period between the literature and the poetry in particular of Old and Middle English.
Thanks to my co-host, Sarah If Decker. Her podcast is Media Evil. Sophomore Lit is brought to you by the Incomparable Network. Find more funny, smart podcasts online at theincomparable.com. You can write to me at sophomore.literature@gmail.com. You can join the discussion on Facebook, or you can look for us on the Incomparable membership Slack. I hope you had a good summer vacation, sophomores, but now that school is back in session, keep up the reading, because everything will be on the final.